rigged with a bite. It's the same sheet on each one, a big long sheet on each one, and we just have a bite on it.
So, what are we seeing?
Both lock gates are open now, and you can see a fair amount of water going through the lock. So, coxswain will move on quite quickly now through the water to try and stay ahead of the race. Now, we've increased dramatically, just coming into the lock now, flying along, surfing out. For us to put up the sails and sail out would be the ultimate, showing off, but we're not going to show off like that.
You're going to be much more Cúramach Ar Fhad, yeah.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, cast flag up, starting sequence.
My name is Trace Young, and today I would be Officer of the Day, which means I start the race.
The race is the October series. The place is Capa Pier in West Clare. And the boat I am most interested in, and that's taking part today, is a boat called the Sally O'Keefe. Now, she is a design that echoes the traditional Irish boats that were used in the local turf trade and the wider boating heritage of the Shannon Estuary back in the 1800s. Those original boats were called turf boats, and there were numerous on the River Shannon at the time. However, the Sally O'Keefe, which is a gaff-rigged wooden sailing boat, despite not replicating her predecessors in design, is similarly purposeful and oh so practical. Do you know, it's the first time I've clapped eyes on her, and she is comfortable looking boat inside. She's comfortable.
Oh, it is, and it's a very good sea boat too. It's got a good high freeboard, be good for the Atlantic swells we've out here. Very seaworthy boat, we're very happy with her.
That's Ned Griffin, who was just one of the many men from around the Quirin area of West Clare, which is located on the banks of the River Shannon, who took it upon themselves to celebrate a part of their local culture and water-faring heritage. They did this by excavating, by researching, by planning, and most importantly, endeavouring to build a boat that embraced the essence of the turf trade. So, how did it all begin? Here's Richard Collins.
We're standing just on the bridge, on Blackwer Bridge, just below Lisdeen Church, on one of the tributaries going into Pondicherry Bay.
So tell me, when we look to the left, there's something very special, literally submerged in the mud over there. Tell me about it.
Yeah, right over there in the mud, there's the remains of an old boat. And it's always been there in my memory, as is now, just with part of the gunwales sticking up over the mud. And when we were asking people about it, some of the oldest people in the area said, oh, that was always there. Even when people, a man down the road here, Randall Coonan, was saying, when he went to school on the West Clare Railway, he used to pass that boat up in the mud. So that's a significant amount of time, because the railway's gone since the early 60s. So we looked around and researched, and we were told it was the remains of one of the old sailing turf boats. So we decided, a few of us, to get a few spades out and to go down over a winter. Now it is submerged at high water, so we had to work with the tides in the weekends, and we were down there in pouring rain and driving snow and all types of stuff over winter, and we managed to clear it out, and we were quite amazed at what we found, because what we found was a turf cot which was used to transport turf out to the sailing boats. Now this is a significant boat in its own right. It's something in the region of 35 foot long and in the region of 10 foot wide. So we dug up this and we cleaned it out and we measured it up and we built a model from it, and then we just put the mud back in over it and let the tide take it back. So it's there for the future.
How long did that measuring process take?
Well, we were working with the tides. We did it over a winter, and you know, you dig out a bit and then the tide comes in, and the next time you come back you have to clean out more, and so it's working with the tide around it. But we did it over winter, probably over about 10 or so days of working on it, and then we had to get it right at the end to get it in there and to get it measured and get all the drawings made up from that. But a very pleasurable process.
About 100 miles away in the Midlands, the Shannon opens up to form Loch Ree. A tributary of the loch is the River Inny, and a lake called Loch Derrivara. It is at Derryvarra that in 1987, another boat used in the vast turf trade was catching the imagination of some of the locals who also sought to reclaim a small part of their history and their heritage.
This particular boat that was raised in Derryvarra in around 1987 would have been in the lake for approximately 70 years. Local stories relate that it was only about a year old or so when a small dispute broke out between natives of Whitehall Parish and Clonaille Parish, probably something innocent, but it meant the demise of the boat. It apparently was brought out and was sank about 200 metres offshore, off Clonaille. Now, prior to 1966, the levels of Derryvarra were quite high, but the 1966 arterial drainage by the Office of Public Works lowered the lake by approximately 6 feet. And as a result of this lowering of the lake, the cot was then visible, and people were actually taking trips out by boat to see this cot, this large boat, down underneath them. Now, in shallow, at certain times of the year when the water levels would go down quite low, we say September, October, it actually became a danger to boat traffic on the lake.
One man and his son, by the name of Brendan Cantwell, had been diving in the lake for years and knew the submerged turf boat very well. They decided to do something that had never been tried in the 70 years that the boat had laid underwater. They decided to raise it and bring it ashore. And tell me, Brendan, why did you actually want to take it out in the first place? Like, there's all the people living right around the whole area, but you were the one and your son who decided to actually do something about it. Why do you think that was? What motivated you?
Yeah, it was a form of madness, honest to God. A form of madness. It's in the family here, honest to God. That was us that time. We were on the lakes and anything but a challenge, we were out for, like, you know. And now I wouldn't do it, but at the time it was like, the young lad was growing up and it was great excitement, even himself and other. And then my son-in-law came over as well, and we all got at it, and the whole family was involved in it. And even local, Michael Conlon, he's the local historian out there, all people came down and helped us because they knew, they wanted to see this famous turf cot being lifted out.
The people of West Clare and the people around Derryvarra Lake both lived close to expansive bogs. Down through the years, these bogs produced vast quantities of turf. In particular, this natural resource and the demands of the nearby bustling Limerick worked well in the people of West Clare's favour. Here's Christopher McCarthy.
About 1809, a man called Thomas Colburn was sent to Clare by the Bog Commission to survey the bogs in West Clare. And of course, they were uniquely very large areas of raised bog, and that's unusual that far west in Ireland. On both sides of the Shannon, in fact, in North Kerry, there's some raised bog there as well. This was very, very deep turf. My uncle, Pat O'Shea, once referred to the area west of Kilrush and on towards northwest to Doonbeg as the Black Trench, because it was literally an unbroken stretch of raised bog and very deep, really good quality turf. And it employed literally hundreds of people, cutting, saving turf, drawing the turf in directly into Kilrush from where it could be shipped out, or mostly to Palnacherry Bay. So all of these hundreds of people that were employed, some of these people, a large number of them were landless labourers who were largely dependent on turf cutting for a good portion of the year.
Now, it's one thing having a resource on your doorstep, but it's another thing altogether to find ways to use that resource to your economic benefit. In order to understand why there were turf cots and turf boats used by the people in the areas, you need to understand how the bog works. Here's Donald Clark, who is a former president of the International Peat Society.
In most parts of Ireland, the system for cutting turf was you took cut drains and took the water out of the bog. In the area we're talking about here in the Limerick and Munster area, it appears that they used what used to be the Dutch system. You cut out the turf, and in doing so you created canals. You then put boats on the canals and use those boats to take the turf away. The way turbary peatlands is organised in Ireland is that most people have their own small turbary, and most of the peat would have been produced by very small people, husbands and wives and children. And they would have then loaded that peat, once it was dry, into a very small boat, a cot, and taken it down through channels cut in the peat out to the main artery on the estuary. At that point, they would have sold their turf to the owner of the turf boat, who would then take it up to Limerick.
I would say from about 1750 that this turf trade really began to grow. As Limerick grew as a city, they needed fuel. Turf was viable. Particularly West Clare turf, it was cheap, it was close by, and it was a dependable source.
Individual households, local farmers, and small merchants bought turf from the turf boats along the river at places such as Bonratty, Foynes, and Askeaton. The turf boats also went up the Maig River and finally moored at the quayside in Limerick. However, it must be mentioned that a bog outside of Limerick, in a place called Castle Connell, served a very important purpose too. Here's Donald Clark again.
It's hard to realise now how important an industrial city Limerick was. And one of the major industries there, starting from around, we think, 1809, was the Stein and Brown Company of Thomond Gate. This was a very large distillery, producing around 250,000 gallons of spirit a year, at a time when the total consumption in Ireland was around 4 million gallons of spirit. Just a measure of the size of the enterprise was indicated by the fact that it had four stills. In order to fire these four stills, they needed an enormous amount of fuel. And the most convenient fuel, because of the way it could be transported up and down the Shannon, was turf. Most of the turf came for this particular enterprise came from a bog known as McNab's Bog, which was upstream of Castle Connell and downstream of Montpellier. We know something of the origins of how they got the peat out from an 1840s ordnance survey map, which shows the canal, known as John's Canal, with the bridge over it, leading down to a stone quay, which is still there, and from the stone quay, the turf was loaded onto boats and shipped down to Limerick. James McNab, who gave his name to the bog, was a Scot who came over and took charge of the bog, we understand, around 1823. This was an enormous enterprise itself. About 300 people were employed every year to produce the turf. They were employed on a seasonal basis. And this is the first example of industrial production of turf. In other words, it wasn't bought from smallholders. It was produced in a managed way, organised and industrialised using employed labour.
So we had two very large turf enterprises supplying Limerick with the fuel that it needed. What they had in common was that they both had to use boats to transport their precious cargo via the Shannon River to the city. What I'm not so clear about is whether the McNab Enterprise used the same type of turf boat as those from County Clare used, namely a gaff-rigged sailboat, similar but smaller than a Galway hooker. What I do know is that when we go up the Midlands and look at the work conducted in the bogs around Derryvara Lake, we know only turf cots were used. So what's the difference?
The word cot, it would originally have meant a log boat, or a dugout canoe is another term for it. And this would have been a boat characteristic of inland waters, not a seagoing vessel. Flat bottomed, very, very wide, approximately 12 feet in beam, midships, but quite long. About 34 feet long. It had been damaged, quite seriously damaged, particularly in the bow area. So this opened up a whole other world for us, and we had to say, right, what have we got here? Did this have something to do with the turf trade? And again, myself and others started to ask questions locally, and we gradually pieced together that the turf cot was an integral part of this whole story, that turf, when it was cut and had been dried and saved, was carried out in these turf cots, out to waiting turf boats, the massive gaff-rigged boats waiting in the very few deeper channels in Palmacherry Bay. And they were propelled using wattles, what they call wattles locally. These are long hazel poles.
On Loch Derrivara, the turf cot never used wattles. The lake was too deep. Instead, the cot was rowed, as Richie McCabe recalls.
The cot boats were used for transporting turf by lake from an area north Derrivara, where the Innie River runs into the lake at a place close to Clonaeve. Now, because the turf cut by sleighing back in that period was quite light, you could bring it by boat, you could stack it up quite high on the boat. The modern day turf cut by machine now and compressed is very, very heavy, and it wouldn't be possible to do a similar exercise now. But that was the means of transport. The route by road from where the turf banks were to householders would have been a long and arduous journey. So obviously the boats came in more useful. Now, four men rowed the boat, two either side. They were of considerable size, again, two and a half times a normal lake boat. And I can remember in and around the 1955-56 seeing what I consider to be the last cot boat used on Derrivara, of a very, very calm day. I was a young teenager at the time, being rowed from the Clonaeve end of Loch Derrivara up to Fahlstown on the shores of Derrivara near to Whitehall. And from there the turf was brought by either horse and cart or ass and cart, whatever was available, to the different households. And that was a pretty recognised way of transporting the turf from that particular area. No tractors, no trailers were available at the time.
That fantastic system, they would load about 6 or 7 tonne of turf on this boat from the lake, from the turf above in Cool. And it would come down the lake, come down the river, and it wouldn't go straight across to Multifarnham. It would come up the lake to get the wind behind it, and then it would go shoot down the lake then to wherever it was going. But they never went straight across the lake, I gather. Maybe it was too dangerous, but they came up the lake first to get the run down it, and then they went with the turf down. It's 6 or 7 tonne of turf on a boat is some load, you know. And they had funerals, there was coffins brought across on it, and there was weddings to the multi-farm, to the Fiery, from Cool. See, there was no roads that time. Roads were very bad and no cars that time, so it was a way of transport.
So in County Clare, the turf cot was used to take the turf from the channels of the bog down to the bigger gaff-rigged turf boats on the Shannon. Around Derrivara, the cot was just as substantial in size. So the question, it has to be asked, how does one manage to remove a turf cot that has remained submerged in water and in the one spot for the last 70 years without breaking it in two? Here's Brenton Cantwell again. So how many days were you at it altogether?
Oh, we were at it for months. We were at it for months, so we'd go out and we'd try something and it wouldn't work, and we'd think up something else. We'd spend nights here thinking about what we were going to do, you know. There was a lot of stones in it, so we had to get the stones out of it and try and clear it. But we had to bring out scaffolding out from the builders, heavy stuff for doing houses. We had our diving gear on, and we had our boat as well, bringing out the stuff, and we would go down and rig up the scaffolding around the boat under the water, and eventually we put some of the scaffolding over the water, and we got these winches. So we started to winch it up anyhow, and it seemed to be moving, but in actual fact what happened was the scaffolding was sinking. So that put pay to that. So then we got cable from the ESB line. No good, it was too soft, that would break. But eventually, a friend of mine who runs a sawmill in town, he said, I'd give you a half inch, three quarters of a mile of a rope. And I said, that should do it. But we were short still about a quarter of a mile, but we had rope. We made it up with ordinary rope, twine ropes. But getting the half inch wire out, it wasn't as simple as that. It was a big drum, and myself and my son, we had to get two barrels, put the drum on it, go out so far with half inch cable, come back and get another layer of it, and then go back and get another layer. So we spent the whole day hard struggling getting the rope out to the boat, and we linked her up to the boat, and then we came back and we phoned our friend, our neighbour, and our helper, Brew Meehan. We distracted Lord of Mercy, he's dead now, but he came down and he started to pull the rope. But unfortunately, the way we were pulling the boat was kind of at right angles to the rope, which meant that we could have actually broken. We were scared in case it would just break in the middle. And we didn't realise what was happening, but my son was out in a canoe watching what was going on at the boat. And he said, "Dad, keep going, I think we have it." So there was this big slush of water came. And then we realised that the boat had loosened. So Brew kept going up to the field, up to the next field, but he didn't want to stop, and across the main road and into another field till we got it right out onto the shoreline.
Did you get any advice, I'm wondering, before you actually set about doing this?
Oh, we did. We got several advices. One was to get the army helicopter and put ropes on it and lift it that way. Another fella says, maybe get a bit of gelatinite and try and blow it out of it. Oh, we got loads of that kind of stuff, all right. We did, yeah, yeah. Fella's bringing out big tankers to pull it out of the water a lot, yeah. But actually, the same day my son was going back to Scotland, and this was our last hope of trying to get out, and we succeeded on the last day we got it over there.
For a wooden boat, which is about 2.5 times the size of a modern-day rowing boat, to remain intact for 70 years submerged in water, it's a bit of a miracle. But it does make you wonder what type of wood it was originally made from. Here's Richie McCabe.
The boat itself possibly was made from larch. This particular area around Derivar would have had a considerable amount of larch trees. Larch would last well. It would have the capacity that would, on the curve, it was less likely to split. Now, other timbers as well could last quite a length of time in water, but there's always a danger that they might split. But larch was the main timber used for making boats at the time.
After all of Brendan's hard work and diligence, I really need to see where this last existing cot was excavated from. And what state is she in today, I wonder? Let's find out. Here's historian Michael Conlon. Is this Brew Meehan's land?
Brew Meehan's land, yeah. Roe died there last week.
Another roe that would shake the innards of you.
Lord. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. But it was all right for an ass and cart in old God's time. As I think it was in somewhere in there now, you can see the lake just ahead of us, and in fact you can see some swans on the lake there as well, and that this is where the boat was taken out and brought out.
But in regards to now where we're sitting, there's a gate in front of us so we can't go any further, and then there's a field, but that is a mighty big field between us and the water, so it just gives me a sense of how far they had to pull this particular boat with the tractor. Brew had to pull the iron rope all that distance, so he did.
Good Lord, yes. When I came out here, the boat was actually out on the shore, so I didn't see the actual taking out of the boat. But it seemed to have been a bit of a job, all right. He probably got in a bit further with the tractor, though, in the field there.
Yeah, well, my understanding from Brendan Cantwell is that not only did he have to pull as far as one field, but he had to go another field, and then he had to go across the road. And it was only when he was across the road that it literally managed to pull the boat out of the water.
Good Lord, no, I didn't hear that story. No, Brendan was a sound man, yeah.
I'm Mick Bourne, a caretaker of the Dangan Reformatory School for the National Museum. It's a store here the last 35 years, so it's all go here in this place. Might as well walk through the place anyway, because it's a strange place, you know. Come on through this door here. Go through the main entrance here now. I'm out the back. This is the main entrance to the building. It was an old school, of course, one time. There was a military barracks here.
That was before it was the reformatory school?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So there's a lot of history. It is, and it's a very old building. So you're going through this, we'll bring you down to the big corridor here. We'll see what it's like as a school time and military barracks time, see?
It's very dark, isn't it?
Very dark, yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's very dark. If you look out the window there, you'll see the old dorms. They were built down in the 40s, and there was another one built on the far side in the 50s. So.
And do you know how many people it catered for, or how many children it catered for?
It catered for, they say, up to 250 at one time. So we're going out the back door here now, and we have the boat out here, which is under cover at the moment.
Right.
But I have some of it stripped back there to let you see it.
Oh, my goodness me.
So I didn't go back too far. I didn't know what much you wanted to see of it. But that's there now a good few years, which it's in good order. That covers on it all the time.
I mean, when you think of it, this was underwater for something like 70 years. It's holding up pretty well.
It is holding up pretty well now. And it's under that tarpaulin there, it's saved the last 20 years now. And, like, it's fairly well minded. We had no place to put it indoors, you know. There was no room for this big boat, you see. And
it's really, really long. I can't get over how long it is.
It's huge, yeah.
It is really huge.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is they don't have the tarpaulin on it at all. They actually have pieces of wood keeping the tarpaulin off it, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's well-minded now. Touch something like that, it's history, isn't it?
It is,
you know,
history.
And you don't know the people that was in them and all that. It's like to know who they were and where they came from would be lovely. Yeah.
But there's also a story, and I have to get to the bottom of the story, but we can't see it here, but there's a big hole in the bottom of this.
Right.
And that hole was made on purpose, and this boat was sunk on purpose over a feud between certain people in the area.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? So it went underwater for that reason, yeah. At the end of the day, if it didn't put underwater, it probably wouldn't be here today. It would have been gone somewhere else.
So thank God for the feud.
Oh yeah, it kept the boat still alive anyway, you know.
The cot used in the turf trade in and around Derryvarra was salvaged and now remains intact but archived. But this is not a fate that Brendan Cantwell ever intended for his beloved turf cot. And you have some thoughts about as to where the turf cot should finally rest.
Well, we want it back in Mullingar or up in Belvedere or Bloomfield or somewhere like that there. We'd love to get it there, but we'll try anyhow. You know, it does belong. It belongs in the Lake District anyhow, and it's the only one left. It's the only one left in Ireland, so it's well worth preserving.
So what became of the West Clare turf cot found near that lovely bridge at Listdeal? Once it had been excavated, carefully measured, photos taken, a model made of it, it then was given back to nature. Today, it lies at the spot where it was excavated from and is awaiting its predictable fate. But something wonderful happened during the whole process. Its excavation led to a synergy that was to become the Sheol Shunnock project. The interest group researched, they planned and eventually built a boat, the Sally O'Keefe, which is in use today. It's taking part in regattas, and most importantly, it'll be used for generations to come. As Richard Collins explains, the Sheol Shunnock project has even bigger plans.
We'd love if there was two or three or four of these boats around the estuary in years to come. We think here with the Shannon estuary, the notion that a boat like this could be built or another community could take on this boat, and we could help them with the plans for it, the building of it. We could help them to sail it and all of that. And then we could help with the insurance cover afterwards as a club-based system. And then we'd all meet up and sail. And part of our effort is we're going to all of these old piers around and taking people out for sail or just let them see the boat and see whether they'd be interested in doing that. There's a lot of interest. And, you know, if people want it enough, it'll be there, it'll be done.
And what of the race, you might ask? Well, at the starting line, this happened.
7, 6, 5, 4. Near collision. By 3 volts.
And despite plenty of wind being around at the start, as the hours went on, it died down completely, and the Sally O'Keefe had to retire along with many other boats. I'm sure it was what used to happen all the time to many of the turf boats making their way up and down to Limerick back in the day. And remember, they did not have the assistance of an inboard or indeed an outboard engine. Yeah, sailing can be tough. I'm Caroline Brennan. Many thanks for listening. This series has been kindly funded by the Sound and Vision Scheme, which is a funding scheme from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.